He's the Prince of Pot.
Remembrance Day ought to be the most important day of the year, commemorating as it does the death and slaughter of young men, women, and civilians because of government lies, deception, politics, and conquest. War is about the tragic loss of human beings on an appalling and colossal scale. Only government power and munitions makers benefit by war. We, the people, as always, suffer at the hands of our government and our so-called enemies. And bear in mind, this Conservative government of Canada plans to spend $450 billion on our Canadian military over the next 20 years. I viewed Romeo Dallaire, a Canadian general commanding the small United Nations peacekeeping force in 1994, when nearly 1 million Tutsi people were slaughtered in just 90 days in Rwanda. Well, he was speaking on CBC's Fifth Estate the other night. Dallaire wrote a book on the horrific carnage he witnessed on that mission called Shake Hands with the Devil. Dallaire spoke at Idea City in Toronto in 2002, as I did on that same day, and we talked admiringly about each other's work in a private conversation later that day. But on this Fifth Estate program, General Dallaire, now a Liberal senator in the government, was commenting on the terrible psychological scars that war and its brutality brings to the soldier. He remarked that 58,000 U.S. soldiers died in the Vietnam War from 1962 to 1973, but 102,000 Vietnam veterans have committed suicide from 1973 to 2007. The real toll of war, he said, is much greater than we are led to believe. Indeed, Dallaire said of the 7,000 Canadian soldiers who have served in Afghanistan since 2002, 133 have died, but perhaps as many as 50 have committed suicide since 2002, and over 2,000 are suffering post-traumatic stress and live damaged, wounded lives. It's worth remembering that 2 million Vietnamese people died in that war of U.S. occupation, and since 2002, 250,000 Afghanis have died from the consequences of the NATO-American-Canadian invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, a war nonetheless closer to being lost to the Taliban than at any other time since 2002. And the Taliban had nothing to do with the attacks on September 11, 2001. That was done by radical Saudi Arabian and Egyptian citizens living in the United States. Osama bin Laden is hiding, if he is alive at all, in Pakistan. And Pakistan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia are still considered allies of the United States. One of my cellmates here at North Fraser pretrial was a Canadian soldier of the 1st Canadian Regiment out of my hometown of London, Ontario. And for 10 years, he served in the military and had one tour in Afghanistan. Along with teaching me hand-to-hand combat and defensive skills, in case I'm attacked in prison, he said, he received many of the training drills. He recited many of the training drills and chants practice he did hundreds of times in Afghanistan, and one of them was, "We kill with this gun because killing is fun. When our enemy is before us, then killing must be done. Our job is to blow them away." And I said, "You can't be serious." He said, "No, no, that I chanted hundreds and hundreds of times during my training both in Canada and Afghanistan." The fake poppy Canadians richly wear in the days leading up to the November 11th commemorates the incredible pain-relieving properties of the opium plant. The poppy being the head of the plant that grows beautifully all over much of British Columbia, and that produces the latex gum that is made into opium, morphine, and heroin. Morphine was used first in World War I on over 20 million of the 30 million wounded soldiers of that four-year war, the most destructive and brutal war in the history of mankind's many wars. Morphine was used to take away the horrible pain of severed limbs, shrapnel-torn bodies, bullet-ravaged limbs, crushed hands, feet, bones, and other hell-born consequences of battle that only a battle-experienced soldier can possibly understand. My father, Alfred Emery, was in the Royal Navy from 1940 to 1945, almost the entire length of World War II. Dad read extensively about war and over 200 books on the subject that were in our family library shelves in the 1960s and 70s. And beginning at the age of 11, I began to read them all, too. Almost all were paperbacks by Ballantine Books, with 12 to 24 pages of black and white photographs in the middle of the book. I remember many of them now. The Battle of Midway was the first book of war I ever read. And other titles I read included Martin Caden's A Torch to the Enemy about the bombing of Japan, and The Day Dresden Died about the Allied bombing of the German city of Dresden being wiped from existence in February 1945, a book called Zero about the Japanese fighter bomber that was the mainstay of the Imperial Japanese Air Force, and The First and the Last, a history of the German Air Force called the Luftwaffe by Adolf Galland. One book my dad had read a few times, and of course I read it too, was one called The Desert Fox, about German Army General Erwin Rommel, a brilliant tank commander fighting the British, my dad in fact, in North Africa. And Dad said he admired this German general, and at age 12 I find that confusing. Wasn't he trying to kill you, Dad, I asked? Yes, my dad said, but he fought alongside his men, he lived as they did, he ate as they did, and he suffered as they did, and he was brilliant in the field. My commanding officer, Field Marshal Alexander Montgomery, was an elitist snob who looked down on his men, and I never liked Montgomery, nor did any of my fellow Navy men. When I asked my dad why he joined the Navy and not the Army or Air Force, he said, well, I was a good swimmer, so if our ship was torpedoed by U-boats, which was the biggest danger at sea, especially in the North Atlantic or Mediterranean Sea, I'd have a good chance of surviving, I thought. In World War I, the infantry just got mowed down by enemy machine gun fire and slaughtered. The thought of dying like that terrified me. And the British Air Force was exclusively for the sons of the rich and the well-to-do, at least at the beginning of World War II, and I was from the poorest of the poor in a Birmingham slum, so the Air Force was not possible for someone like me. If you volunteered, you could choose which service to join, the Army or Navy. So at 16, I lied about my age, said I was 18, and the Battle of Britain was underway that month, so I joined and they willingly took me. They didn't look too closely at the age of any fit, able-bodied young man in those days. I had been working full-time at the Norton Motorcycle Factory since I was 13, so I was growing up already amongst men. I thought I would sign up at 16 if I could, so that if I could, I could choose the Navy over the Army. If I wanted, if I waited until I was drafted, I would have probably ended up in the Army. When I asked, well, how did you become a good swimmer, Dad, knowing he lived in the inner cities of Birmingham, England, he said, well, my brothers and I would swim in the canals. And I asked Dad, I said, well, what were the canals, Dad? And he looked at me and he sort of said, well, son, the canals were actually the sewers, really, but I never thought of it much about it at the time. I just knew that was the only place I could swim. And I remember looking at my dad with horror. I said, Dad, you swam in sewers for fun? And he looked at me and he'd say wistfully, well, I guess I did, son, and I became a very good swimmer, too. That's the only place there was to swim for a poor working man, son. Like many veterans of World Wars, my dad spoke warmly of the camaraderie between his mates who depended on each other. He confided to me that his 5 years on destroyers and cruisers traveling at sea around the continent of Africa, stopping in ports like Durban, South Africa, and Mombasa, Kenya, and Alexandria, Egypt, and Benghazi, and Tripoli, Libya, Malta, Tel Aviv, Palestine, and Cape Town, South Africa, were the best years of his life, adding to my confusion. One clue was the giant tattooed eagle on my dad's right upper arm. When I was 8 years old and my dad was reading, I sidled up to him and remembered asking, well, Dad, can I just stand here next to you while you read? And he'd say, sure, son. I wanted to have a good look at that tattoo, that giant eagle, and that was in 1966. Tattoos were rare then. Only sailors and ex-convicts had them, rather, and certainly not on women as is so common today. Dad, I asked, why did you get this tattoo? And he said, well, it's my Navy tattoo, son. We all got one in the Navy. I ran my finger slowly over the complex lines in the eagle's wings. In the middle of the eagle was a box with a word in it. Breaking the silence, I spelled the short word out, B-E-T-T-Y, Betty. Dad, who is Betty? I asked my dad many uncomfortable questions over my young years, and he would say, listen, never be afraid to ask me anything, Mark. If I know, I'll tell you, and if I don't know, we'll look it up. Well, this was the first of many uncomfortable questions, and Dad looked at me, and he put his book down. Mark, son, I'll tell you who Betty was, but please never mention this to your mother. My mom's name was Eileen, and Dad and Mom had been married 16 years at this time in 1966, so I'd never thought of anybody else in my father's life except my mom, Eileen. But my dad added, it's not that she doesn't know the story, son, but it bothers her greatly and it'll hurt her to think about it, so please don't mention it. Well, Betty's son was my true great love. She was a beautiful, wonderful woman in Durban, South Africa, and my ship would stop in Durban every 2 to 3 months and stay for 3 to 14 days at a time. I was more in love with Betty than any other woman in my entire life. She was wonderful. I remember my dad's eyes would trail off into a gaze, his voice soft and conspiratorial as he confessed this to me, and he gulped a sad little swallow before continuing. You know, I saw her at every opportunity, Mark, I could for 3 years, and we were crazy for each other. I promised at the end of the war I would come and get her and marry her, and in June 1945, after Germany surrendered, and I had saved up enough money to get on a ship from Southampton, England after my discharge, and go get her in Durban. A trip like that took 3 weeks, and I was so excited. But when I got there in Durban, her father refused to let her see me, and had men forcefully and firmly tell me never to contact her, and that I would never see her again, and that was that, and that I would never be allowed to marry her, and not to try anymore, and I'm afraid I never did see her again. Why, Dad? Why? I was shocked, he said. Because Betty was gentry, son. Her dad owned a huge farm, a lot of land, a business, and he determined that no poor son of a chimney sweeper was going to marry his daughter. It was the class system that all England grew up under, and I was from the poorest of the poor, and she was from the well-to-do, and that, unfortunately, in those days was simply that. I loved Betty more than anyone else in the whole world, save my mother. I remember the finishing of that story. Dad had moisture in his eyes on this confession. He had many pleasant stories of his time in the Navy, getting dunked in the ocean in a big net when passing over the equator, and always warm-hearted stories of hijinks between he and his mates. But when on those occasions I persisted with, "Tell me about battles, Dad. Tell me about the battles that when you fought. What was the closest you came to getting killed?" His eyes became cold and distant. He rarely spoke of those things. But occasionally, because I was too young and insensitive to realize, he did not want to think of those times. His voice would become grave and slow, and he breathed in heavily, and he intoned, "The screams of the wounded, my mates going on for hours, throughout the night on a battlefield or out at sea until they died, haunted you. They haunted you, son, for days, nights, months, and years. If you saw a close mate killed or maimed, arms ripped off by exploding shrapnel," or he would pause, and I could see he was getting very kind of choked up, "or worse, I saw worse on the field of battle." His voice trailed away, and then I understood it was time to change the subject, but I always came back with more questions to disturb him. "What was the closest you came to getting killed, Dad?" He'd look at me with an air of resignation. "Well, okay, I'll tell you, but I don't like to talk about those times. When my ship was taking supplies to Malta, the Luftwaffe was waiting to attack our convoy as we approached. Stuka dive bombers and Messerschmitt fighter aircraft brought down a furious assault on our ship and all the others. I remember running like a son of a bitch, and believe me, my dad never swore normally, so this was important. He said I was running to my gunnery station and looking right ahead at the Messerschmitts coming right down at me, strafing the ship and the crew, and was right in his gun sights, and then it was zip, 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 zip. A torrent of bullets, I could almost feel them go to my left side into the ship, all missing me by inches or less. I got to my gun and fired at them as the fight went on for a furious 45 minutes, but I didn't get hit, though some of my mates did. My best friend on board died that day from bullet wounds." On another day, when he agreed to answer my pestering questions about war, he said, "Son, the noise of the guns, the rockets, the bombs, the machine gun fire, the mortars, the cannons, all this deafening racket going off all at the same time was maddening. It was stupefying in a way that no movie or book can convey. It would make you mad nuts if you were to hear it for too long, and sometimes I thought I would go insane just from the torrents we would hear." And then, like all those other difficult conversations, he would be quiet and seemingly far, far away. By the time I was 14 and had read dozens of those Ballantine paperbacks on war, my father, mother, and I would watch a very gripping series from BBC on Canadian television called The World at War, airing originally from 1970 to 1974, but it's rerun all the time on A&E to this very day. Every Sunday night a new episode aired, and I was mesmerized by all this authentic film footage of adrenaline-fueled combat in the air, at sea, and on the battlefield. One day, Mom and Dad had a big, long discussion before allowing me at 14 to watch a very special, explicit episode of The World at War. Mom and Dad argued for hours early in the day whether I should be permitted to watch it. I quietly tried to overhear their debate from in the TV rec room from my bedroom. And then at the end of the discussion, my dad said with finality, "That is what happened. This is the truth, and he will need to know." So at 7 p.m. on a Sunday, this episode was even more serious than usual, the narrator's voice grim and serious, and I was indeed gripped by horror while watching it. It was about concentration camps, extermination camps. It was about Jewish people being rounded up, executed by machine gun, put in huge torture camps and gassed in concrete brick rooms. Naked, emaciated women, children, and tiny men humiliated and degraded before being incomprehensibly executed. Thousands upon thousands. Their nakedness confounded me. I had not seen humans paraded naked before and was shocked at that. And then the corpses of the dead piled high, and the long rows of naked women being machine gunned into trenches that they had to dig only moments before their imminent death. I was crying after 20 minutes of watching this, but I watched it all. My mom glowered at my dad as she was disgusted by the moment. My dad sighed as I cried and cried and burst out questions to my sweet dad about how that my sweet dad could not answer for me. "Why did they kill all those Jewish people, Dad? Why are they all naked? How can anyone kill like that? How could people film this and not do something to stop it? It doesn't make sense, Dad. Why would anyone do this?" And my dad couldn't really answer me, and he didn't look me in the eye because it was one of those rare times when Dad did not have the answer. war, son. It is hell. Government propaganda and lies can convince a man to torture and murder his own neighbor if enough pressure is applied. I'm sorry you have to see this, son. If they ever have a war, son, and they make you go, you run, Mark, and you run fast. And you never go to any war. War is the rich and powerful and politicians using the poor and working class as cannon fodder to die for their evil politics, and you remember that, son. But through my tears, I said, but Dad, you said that war years were the best years of your life when you were in the Navy, and this is so, so terrible. And my dad said, that's because I had my mates. I loved Betty and thought of her every day, and I love the sea. And I was from a very poor place in the world, Mark. I was nothing. I'm just a small slum dweller from Birmingham, England. In the Navy, I went to all these exotic places in the world, in Africa, in the Middle East, in Italy, Malta, North Africa, and I didn't know about these terrible things until much later, after the war, when the truth always comes out, and it's usually far too late. Dad couldn't explain to me why Jews were targeted for this extraordinary persecution. In all my days at home, I'd never heard him utter a bigoted word or remark of any kind. He was a sweet and charming person to all people, and he imbued upon me a great goodwill to all people without even the slightest suggestion of prejudice. My continual stream of questions about man's humanity, inhumanity to man at that age of 13, 14, and 15 perplexed my father, and he found it challenging to explain to me in terms that made any sense to a young man as to why there was bigotry, hatred, and war in the world. But he often added, that's why I brought you into this world in Canada, son, where you wouldn't experience these prejudices I experienced in England, or being poor, or being working class, or of a class system, or for other people it's being judged because they are Jewish or Negro, or any of those other things that aren't important. That's why I'm glad you're Canadian, son, so you will never know those attitudes that cause misery to a person for no good reason. My dad worked at the 3M factory in London, Ontario, where I'm from. And that's where he worked his whole life until he retired in 1981 after 30 years of service to that company. I knew his best friend at work was Nick Sauter, from whom I fondly called Mr. Nick. Since I was 4 years old, I knew Mr. Nick was German-born, and I asked my dad how he could be friends with a German man who, when for 5 years Germans were trying to kill my dad, and he replied, Mark, that is war. When war is over, you have to forget all that. There is no point to hate or holding grudges. Life is so short, and we must go on. My dad was the greatest, wisest man I ever knew, and with just grade 8 schooling, as was common for poor English people in the Great Depression, but I marveled at almost every day growing up as I watched him fix anything, build anything, answer all my questions, or know where to find the answer. He never raised his voice to my mother, and he certainly never struck her. He drank one beer, a bottle of Molson Canadian, once a week at 8:30 on Saturday night as the CBC telecast of Hockey Night in Canada began. I had a glass of pop, and each of us had a bowl of Lay's potato chips. Then, in 1965, the Leafs would be broadcast in progress about 15 minutes into the first period because Tommy Hunter's Jubilee, an hour-long music variety show, occupied the 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. spot. In those days of the original 6 hockey teams, hockey started at 8 p.m., and the games started at 7 p.m. were broadcast in their entirety, starting only in 1969. I only ever had one argument with my dad my whole life, long after I left home, which I did at 17. The argument was when I was 31 years old and Dad was 65. It was on Christmas Day in 1990, 7 days before Canada and the U.S. would begin Operation Desert Storm, the bombing and invasion of Iraq, after Saddam Hussein had his troops invade Kuwait and seize their oil fields. Kuwait was an invention of the Western powers at the end of World War II. Originally, it was part of Iraq before then. Throughout that December, I had been protesting Canada's participation in the build-up to the bombing, called Operation Desert Shield, by carrying a sign in front of Wolseley Barracks, the home of the 1st Canadian Regiment, on Oxford Street in my hometown of London. Canada was contributing a squadron of CF-18 Starfighter bombers to contribute to the largely American bombardment of Iraq. In the weeks prior to the aerial bombing, which started on January 1st, there was me and 25 to 100 people protesting each day in front of those barracks. But once the aerial bombardment began on the new year, it was the event that really made CNN, for example, a worldwide phenomenon. It captured the horrific bombing live in real time on TV so everybody could watch. Well, I found myself alone that day in Wolseley Barracks protesting with one sign I would wear like a sandwich board draped over me. My sign said, Canadian bombs on Iraqi people is wrong and immoral. The other protesters who were with me before the bombing began were nowhere to be found now. And in front of Wolseley Barracks, there was just me. All had seemed to buy into the belief that once your country is at war, you, quote, you have to support the troops and support your country. Every day as I walked a snowy protest line in front of the 1st Canadian Regiment Barracks by myself, after the bombing commenced, dozens of insults would be hurled at me every hour. I dodged bottles that were thrown at me from cars careening by. Snowballs were often lobbed my way from cars. Even bags of excrement, human, dog, and cat were tossed my way by passing vehicles. I was stunned by this behavior. I couldn't get my head around the popular belief that protesting your country at war was only acceptable before any actual killing began. Once the killing began, it was somehow treasonous to point out the horror and immorality of killing innocent men, women, and children from the sky above once it was actually happening. Most shocking was that my dad joined in this chorus. On Christmas Day 1990, as the family met at my brother Matt's house on Springbank Drive in London for our turkey dinner, Dad was spouting the popular propaganda of the corporate media and our governments, that Saddam Hussein was the new Hitler, that Saddam ordered babies ripped from hospital incubators, that women were being raped en masse, and of course most of it was untrue upon later verification. I couldn't believe my ears, and Dad and I went at it at a thunderous pace for 2 or 3 hours until the holiday spirit was pretty well ruined. I yelled at him in the very heat of argument. You told me 20 years ago that if they ever had a war, I should run away. You said all wars were lies and deception so the powerful could kill the innocent, the poor, the working classes, and now you are saying these crazy lies yourself, giving support to this insane killing. Months later, when Saddam Hussein was allowed to stay in power amidst the slaughter and wreckage of the ordinary Iraqi conscripts and citizen, I asked my father what he thought about the bombing now. He sighed and said, "Let us never speak of that again." I learned war can indeed divide families, if only for one day. If you watched a DVD about my work, The Prince of Pot, U.S. versus Mark Emery, one of the extra scenes is a debate between my older brother Stephen, an Anglican Christian minister, and myself about Canada's participation in the occupation of Afghanistan. Steve's only son, Corporal Benjamin Emery of the Princess Pat Regiment, had returned from his second tour of duty in Afghanistan, and Steve was proud of his son. But even though we hadn't seen each other in 3 years, we argued immediately about Afghanistan and the Canadian soldiers there. Steve was saying, "You don't believe we have to stop Islamofascism before it comes to Canada," and words I regarded as pure propaganda. It's quite the heated debate, which you can see on the DVD, but then happily we stopped arguing suddenly and spoke warmly of other matters. Canadians have served as soldiers in many futile, purposeless wars, like the Boer War of 1897 to 1901, the First World War, and the First Iraq War. The slaughter of Canadians in World War I battlefields like Vimy Ridge, Ypres, Passchendaele, the Somme are so horrific and the casualties so great and enormous, I urge you all to read the many great books about that war. Most of those Canadians died in a small area in eastern France along the German border in muddy, wet fields and trenches. 60 million people, civilians and soldiers, died in Europe in 4 years of futile war. 10 million more people died around the world following the November 11th armistice from a worldwide influenza pandemic that feasted on an exhausted, weakened, and malnutritioned world population. When Canadian soldiers, many like my dad, were only 16 or 17 or 18 years old and died on those horrible battlefields or in hospital suffering wounds, nurses and soldiers most often heard the words that left their lips upon their last dying breath, "Mother, oh mother, I need you, Mom. Where are you, Mom?" And then they were gone. The staggering loss of life on European battlefields necessitated the Canadian government to invoke what was called conscription, or the draft, in World War I and II, forcing all able-bodied men 18 to 27 into the armed forces into battles. Yet few Canadians know that fully half of all Alberta and Saskatchewan boys took my dad's advice, and likely their own dad's advice at the time, and ran away and hid when the Northwest Mounted Police showed up at their farmhouse to compel them away to war. Mostly these unwilling men and boys were children of German, Irish, Russian, Ukrainian, Hungarian, French, Canadian, Jehovah's Witness, Dukabor, and other non-British immigrants. That made up most of the early settlers of the Prairie Provinces. This rounding up of pacifists and war resistors was the first assignment of what is now the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the RCMP. Thousands of Canadian conscripts were led up the troop ship gangplanks in Halifax in leg irons and chains to prevent their escape. Camp Borden and other military training camps had high barbed wire fencing around them to deter the thousands who wanted to desert. Conscription riots occurred throughout Quebec in 1917 and 1918 as fully 25% of those drafted refused to go willingly and also had to be taken in chains. When the war was over November 11, 1918, the politicians of the victorious nations deranged the peace afterward, called the Treaty of Versailles, and they carved up Europe, Africa, and the Middle East so grotesquely that it created the circumstances that made World War II, the Israeli-Arab wars, and even African and Middle Eastern civil wars inevitable. In addition to Canada's role in the Boer War, World War I and II, and the Korean War, Canadians have participated in over 130 so-called peacekeeping missions, often futile and ineffective at keeping any peace, for example, in Somalia, Rwanda, Bosnia, Cyprus, and Haiti. When I was treating drug addicts of heroin, morphine, and methamphetamine and cocaine at the Iboga Therapy House in 2002, my oldest patient I treated was a 60-year-old veteran of the Canadian Forces who had been addicted to morphine since his time as a peacekeeper in the Congo. This is his story as he told it to me. I grew up without a dad, and I was wild and getting into trouble. I figured I needed some discipline, and I didn't have it, so I joined the Canadian Army at age 18, figuring I could get that father-like structure in my life that was to straighten me out and to give me some proper goals. Well, after 3 months training, my company was sent to join a United Nations mission in the Belgian Congo. There was the beginnings of a violent independence movement occurring, and the UN was there to keep a very tentative truce between the white Europeans, mostly Belgians, and the competing black independence militias and guerrilla groups. So there I am in the Congo, age 18, and all hell breaks out. There's really just a few of us Canadian UN peacekeepers, and the black militias and black Congolese generally start killing and raping the white Europeans, and doing so in horrific ways. The whites started to flee, and the UN soldiers are so outnumbered that we have orders not to fire, even though we're right in the middle of this horrific carnage. Then blacks turn on blacks as well as the whites. One day I was trapped observing a mass killing and saw white and black women disemboweled, pregnant women with their stomachs slashed open while they were alive, and fetuses were being ripped out of their bodies. I heard women being raped savagely day and night for days. Kids, women, men, whites, blacks, macheted to death, tortured, shot, decapitated. It was absolute terror for days on end. The blood-curdling screams of the victims haunt me to this day, and that's 40 years later. Within 3 months of being there, I'm just 19 now. I'm so far gone, I tried to kill myself, and I shot myself. I didn't die, though. I lost one kidney and gave myself permanent nerve damage to my back and spine. Ever since, I've been prescribed morphine for my back pain, but I became dependent on the morphine, and it's messed up my life in later years. So now I want a morphine-free life for what few remaining years I have left. That's why I'm here, Mark. I'm hoping you can help me get off this morphine addiction and these terrible things I've been thinking for 40 years. That was 2002. I haven't kept up with what's become of him. His name was Ron. I don't know where he's been since then. Such is the smoothness of propaganda and the dereliction of real remembrance. Everyone wears a symbolic poppy, but few can explain its significance. In the poem for the dead in Flanders Fields by John McCrae, he goes, "In Flanders Fields the poppies blow between the crosses row on row." It's important to remember that opium poppies were deliberately planted on the graves of the dead by the thousands, the tens of thousands, to highlight the great botanical gift opium was to every soldier. Now our soldiers in Afghanistan, carrying out the politics of prohibition in faraway places, betray the soldier's best friend with a disgraceful campaign of herbicide. So here's to all the boys and men robbed of their lives whose last cry was for their mother, girlfriend, wives, or other loved ones who died in the uniform of this nation of Canada for the cynical benefit of our government and its deadly politics. Across the street from the Cannabis Culture Headquarters is Victory Square, a badly misnamed place for the honored dead of World War I, and there is the phrase on the side of the obelisk there. It says, "Is it nothing to you?" meaning the sacrifice of these men. But ultimately, the sacrifice will continue until we embrace words like Martin Luther King, whom I admire and read for comfort in this jail. And Martin Luther King had this to say, "If we retaliate with hate and bitterness, the new age will be nothing but a duplication of the old age. We must blot out the hate and injustice of the old age with love and justice of the new. This is why I believe so firmly in nonviolence. Violence never solves problems. It only creates new and more complicated ones. If we succumb to the temptation of using violence in our struggle for justice, unborn generations will be the recipients of a long and desperate night of bitterness, and our chief legacy to the future will be an endless reign of meaningless chaos."